Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our conversations include you. And if you'd like to join us anytime during the program, the phone lines are open. 941-3689. 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, that's the number to use. From the neighbor islands, it's 877, then the 941-3689. Earlier this year, the description of the diagnosis of autism was revised, and you may remember that a few months ago we spoke about the changes in the latest Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-5. Regardless of how the words morph, families are still left to negotiate how they find help for their autistic kids, from identifying the right therapies to isolating the right food and the money to pay for it all. It can be tough to put all those pieces together. This evening on Town Square, a look at what families with autistic children face right now and how it compares to their mainland counterparts. Joining me is Dr. Jeff Stern, an assistant professor of psychology at Hawaii Pacific University, where he's the clinical internship director of their master's program in clinical mental health counseling. He's also a licensed psychologist and the past president of the Hawaii Psychological Association. For 20 years, he has specialized in working with Hawaii kids with neurodevelopmental disabilities, particularly those with hearing and visual loss, autism spectrum disorder, and ADHD. Joining us as well is Leolinda Parlin. She is a state coordinator for Family Voices of Hawaii, and she's also the principal investigator for several Maternal Child Health Bureau federal grants. She's the mother of a 19-year-old son in the autism spectrum and a typically developing 18-year-old daughter. She was the moderator for last month's seminar, Autism, Putting the Pieces Together. It was presented by Mental Health America of Hawaii. And from that organization, its executive director, Maria Grams, is here. She holds a MS in clinical psychology and helped develop Healing the Trauma of War, the Invisible Children's Project, Stop Youth Suicide and Bullying Program, and an employment program for homeless female veterans and homeless male veterans with children. We've got a lot of knowledge around our table, and if you have a child in the autism spectrum, we want to hear from you too. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you call us from other than on Oahu. And thank you all for joining us tonight. You can say hello. It's okay.
Hi, Beth Ann.
Hi. Nice to have you here. You know, it's been a long time since we took a long, deeper look into what's happening in Hawaii with autism. And Leolinda, you and I spoke a little earlier this summer, right before the seminar on autism that you were working with as its moderator. But, you know, it's tough for a lot of families, and it's also tough for the community because in some ways the rest of us don't know how to respond to all the changes. Let's talk a little bit about autism and how autism has changed in the last 3 to 5 years, where it seems we're now knowing so much more about brain function and brain development.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. And thank you again for having us today, Beth Ann. It's always an opportunity that I treasure to be with you as well as to be able to talk about autism. You know, I think in the last 3 to 5 years, what we've seen is just this massive awareness, you know, whether it's through nationally on TV stations, on TV shows, on prime time where a regular host character of a series is in the spectrum, whether it's on the front page of the newspaper or magazines, definitely we've seen this awareness of what autism is has significantly increased. I think we've seen a lot of increase and also in screening and the number of children that are actually screen, where we actually have tools that we're using now that are specifically will predict whether or not a child's delays, you know, if you look at them together, will, you know, probably tell us that they are in the spectrum. And the deployment of the screening, whereby now the feds have now set guidelines where they want every child in the U.S. to be screened by age 2 for autism. They want them screened by age 2. They want them further evaluated and assessed by age 3. And receiving services by age 4.
I mean, that's a far cry from where things were.
Absolutely.
5, 10 years ago, where people were going, autism, huh? And not really being able to talk about it, much less say, make sure you have your kids screened by 2.
Exactly. And to have consensus and agreement that there is a direction, I mean, that's incredibly huge in our fight to become more aware.
Jeff, you know, some of the figures that we have seen over the past few years indicate, at least from the CDC, that autism spectrum disorder growing anywhere between 10 to 20%, 10 to 17%, somewhere in there. Is that still true?
I'm not sure about the actual numbers. I think studies vary, but first, let me thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate the invitation. I think what we're seeing is an increase in prevalence that is staggering. Back 20 years ago, when I was in grad school, it was like 6 per 10,000 births, and now it's anywhere between 1 in 38 and 1 in 88, depending on this particular study you look at. So this incidence prevalence rate has really skyrocketed, and a lot of people are wondering why that is. And I think some of it has to do with our ability to detect and diagnose this.
Well, the fact that we're now telling people you should get your kids screened before age two or by
yes.
age two.
And that's correct. And I also think some of it is the diagnostic criteria. We used to really be very categorical in the way we diagnosed autism. You either fit this and fit in this box or you didn't. And now I think psychiatry and psychology are recognizing, psychology has for a little while, I think both organizations have, that it's very dimensional and that it's a very wide dimension for autism spectrum. Autism spectrum disorder is a new term. Mm-hmm. Previously, we had all these different discrete diagnostic categories, and now we just have autism spectrum disorder.
I mean, things like Asperger's. I mean, we would name things, and now we just have this spectrum.
Correct.
Does that make it easier to talk with parents when you don't have a very specific kind of name for it, when it sort of all fits along the spectrum, or does it make it tougher?
I try not to talk too much about the label. I think the label is misleading at times. Maybe better now that it's a spectrum. But I talk about the specific behaviors and symptoms that we're seeing and that the parents are describing to me so that I don't start throwing things around at them. And I wait to hear what they what they're concerned about and what they're expressing about their child. And then I kind of show them that the behaviors that they're seeing and the symptoms that they're seeing are part of this group on the spectrum. And many of them already had a suspicion about it. And I think it helps that I'm a little bit more sensitive to the fact that I'm not just throwing labels at and saying, is it this, is it that, but rather letting them describe what they're seeing to me. And then let's talk about how you feel about the label.
Mario, jump in here too.
I was just going to say, getting back to the explosion in the amount of children who are being diagnosed, yeah, there are better services. Yes, there's better diagnosis. There may be a lessening of stigma. There's more awareness. But something else is going on. You know, there is something in the environment. You know, we're seeing the same kind of skyrocketing rates of childhood bipolar disease and of asthma and of conditions like that. So something's happening, not just that we're, you know, recognizing it more, but there's got to be something around us that's causing a lot of these problems to erupt.
You seem to be making a case for the confluence of different factors. Maybe not just what one is born with, but being enhanced by what you're around. And something that we can talk about more because we're training attention on it.
Yeah, it's all of that, and you can't really tease it apart.
So if we can't tease it apart, how much more difficult does that make it to be able to not only just diagnose but treat and have acceptance within the community?
Well, you know, there are a lot of complicated conditions like autism. Most of the mental illnesses are similarly complicated. And I know our president has talked about mapping the brain. And if that happens, and if it is what we're hoping it will be, then we'll be really on the road to understanding how these things operate, what parts of the brain, what neurotransmitters, what disorders in the brain. And right now we're at the beginning, at the very beginning of knowing anything about any of these conditions. So the complicatedness of autism, like the complicatedness of schizophrenia or bipolar illness or of developmental disorder, you know, none of them are going to be easy.
But the attention that we've generally been able to place on mental illness and mental health over the last 5 to 10 years particularly seems to make it a little bit more approachable. Or is that just a false hope?
I would say stigma is alive and well. And the lack of understanding is very prevalent. And I don't mean just by the public, but I mean by our experts. you know, I was giving a talk the other day about mental illnesses, and we were talking about the different ones, and they were saying, well, how are they diagnosed? Is there a test? And I said, no, there's no test. And it's an art. And most people's conditions are blurred. You know, it's not like you have this or you have this. Everything is mixed up, and it takes looking at symptoms, just like with autism. You know, where you are on the spectrum, do you have, how much cognitive disability do you have? How much behavioral disturbances do you have? How much, what the speech issues are? You know, there's just so many factors, but none of them are easy to diagnose.
Isn't it sort of ironic in a way that we would try not to make it as messy as it is, to try to put it into little boxes, when clearly from mm-hmm. everything we've learned and what we are continuing to learn about the brain shows us that those boxes are just complete constructs that have no basis
right.
in reality.
There's no empirical evidence to support the kind of categorical model that was prevalent for years, and that's, I think, why we've moved away from it and more towards a dimensional model of understanding of these spectrum types of disorders, including the fact that anxiety and depression seem to be on the same dimension.
Yes. I almost dropped out of graduate school because I had mental health problems, and none of the diagnoses fit me. None of them. None of them made sense, you know? And I still think that's true for a lot of people.
So here we are trying to grapple with mental illness generally, and specifically talking today about what's going on with families with autism. Leolinda, she makes a point, Mario makes a point, that there's a lot of stigma, that parents are still dealing with those issues too, and that getting services, all of that, maybe has gotten a little better, but really we're still dealing with a big problem here. You talk to a lot of parents. You are a parent of a child with autism. And yes, I know he's 20 years old, but he still always will be your baby.
This is true. This is true.
What happens when you get together with other parents and look just at what's happening in Hawaii? Is it any better or worse?
You know, I think it's much better than what it was. I think what we're seeing are pockets of excellence. I'm talking to families whose children are younger and younger each year, that they've had early identification, that they're getting individualized plans at their schools. But then these are pockets of excellence. I think we've come so far in 20 years, but we're not at the point yet where it's systematized, where it's every school, every time, every kiddo is going to have that same level of support and attention and knowledge in the treatment from their, you know, the community that's servicing that child. And so I think we've made some significant gains, but we've got a little bit more to go. I think that the understanding is greater, you know, that people have a little bit more awareness. I think the challenge with, you know, these hidden disabilities are just that, because they tend to, what you see first are the behaviors with the child, mm-hmm. you know. And so then that, you know, lack of judgment or not, I mean, we tend to look at kiddos and say that's a reflection of the child or the poor parenting. And so mm-hmm. there's already that distance that we separate, as opposed to, you know, thinking about there may be other factors that are involved in the child's behavior. And so there still is that distancing of families from the general community.
There was a story at our seminar we had of a father who had his child at McDonald's, and the child was severely autistic and had a total meltdown. And somebody came over to him and said, "What the F are you doing in here with your child? Get the F out of here. You know, you have no business in here." And just, you know, screamed at him. And the father said sort of humorously that he was thinking of getting a T-shirt that said, you know, "I'm autistic, cool it."
Right, exactly. So it's kind of that knee-jerk response, I think, oftentimes is not, you know, accepting or understanding. And I think that's one of the struggles. So families, you know, do you work all day long to care your kids, provide for them, and then engage a community that may not be receptive? Do you keep going back? Do you keep continuing to try to make inroads? So there's almost like a self-imposed isolation that sometimes families put themselves through, just because it's a whole lot easier
than having problems like the story that Mari just told about the kid in McDonald's. But that's not the kid's fault, and it's not the parents' fault. And why is it that they should have to feel that they need to be isolated?
Well, it's really hard to be around a kid, you know, to have a kid who's very, very different.
But
and
any
be around,
kid has
quote,
a meltdown.
Quote, normal kids. Yeah, but when kids have meltdowns, don't you see the looks that the parents are getting? Like, you know, what's the matter with you? Can't you control your child? So
we had a similar situation a few years ago. So it wasn't that long ago. My son was still in high school. And we had gone to the latest release of a new Disney movie that he had anticipated. It was a Saturday matinee. And he had memorized the ads. So when the movie came on and he came to the part, he was reciting the dialogue. And it wasn't very loud. I was sitting next to him. I didn't think it was more than any other child in the filled theater. And when we left, these two adults came up to me and they said, "Thanks a lot. Your child just ruined the movie for us." It's just, and he just ranted about what an awful experience it was being near us in the theater. And I was taken aback. I was shocked. I didn't know how to respond. I apologized. I tried to buy them tickets to go see the next movie so they could have a better experience. He said, no, we can't. There'll never be an opportunity
okay, so they were jerks. I mean, yeah. there's no other way to talk about
but
somebody who feels that free to come up and tell you something like that when clearly you can't, you're trying to fix it and they don't want to accept your apology or the fix for it. And you're in a theater with a whole bunch of kids.
At a kid movie, right. But that experience, I wasn't ready to go to the movies again the next day. I mean, you know, it took me a while to kind of toughen up the skin to go to another event just in case there would be that kind of a situation.
Well, you know, there's good news because in a couple other states, families have gotten together and they take over a movie theater or get together, and it's all kids with autism. So nobody's going to yell at them.
Right.
There's an effort to bring that to Hawaii.
Yes.
Parents want to get together to do that.
Well, I mean, there are things like crybaby matinees where you can bring your little kid or your baby and watch a movie. And if the baby cries, nobody's going to get upset because everybody's got a kid. But on one hand, that is kind of fun to think about a bunch of autistic families coming together to be able to have a nice, fun time at a movie and whatever happens, happens. On the other hand, we talk so much about being inclusive and embracing diversity and all these lovely things, and we don't walk the talk. Or do we, Jeff? Is this just asking too much of people to go to a movie and possibly have a kid reciting dialogue?
I think it's there are a lot of complicating factors. I think environmental factors, culture plays a part of it. I think tolerance and expectations about behavior vary by culture. And that may be playing out. I think institutions like the Department of Education and the Department of Health have their own cultures, and they have the change and development that occurs at the pace that is comfortable for their own environment and their culture. So, for example, the Department of Education was tasked with handling serious neurodevelopmental disabilities, and they're making good progress. But that's a huge burden to put on the system. And I think a lot of people are still questioning whether or not their child who's in regular education is being taken away. Educational money is taken away from them to fund these children who are, you know, absorbing a disproportionate amount of funds. So I think that there's maybe some misunderstandings and there's expectations that are institutional and cultural that complicate things. But I do agree that stigma is still there. And I think it's a matter of people, you know, stepping up. I mean, I've been in a situation at Kahala Mall, for example, where I saw a kid have a meltdown and other people, you know, make face. And I kind of went over to them and I said, you know, give the kid a break. Give the family a break. I can see from your face that you're unhappy. And you know, if it's bothering you that much, you can walk away. It's okay.
Good for you. Good for you.
But I don't think that's a common behavior.
No, especially you talk about culture, the idea of, you know, looking askance is one thing, but actually walking over to somebody else and telling them to cool it is quite another. And for a lot of cultures, that's trespassing.
Yeah, well, I'm a white male, so maybe that's a double-edged sword for me.
Not making a judgment on,
it's
on
your
on
genetic
what you
makeup.
I can't help myself. I'm
but
sorry.
For you know, parents and you know, which one of us has not been in a situation where your kid, for whatever reason, has had a meltdown and you feel torn between trying to make your kid hop too so that everybody else isn't upset with you and also knowing that your kid's having an experience and you have to be able to focus on your kid, not what everybody else thinks. That's a really tough balance in the normal way, let alone when you overlay autism. And, you know, whether the kid has to wear a shirt that says, "I have autism, cool it," that seems to be, in a way, cruel. Because the rest of us can't get our act together. Hmm. So what about this business of diversity and inclusion. You talked a lot when you were here last time with me, Leo, about what this community needs to do in understanding kids like yours.
Right. You know, it's funny. I was just struck with, you know, the optimist in me says it's going to take a generation. You know, so for my son, you know, he was pretty much all through his academic career in most of his day was in inclusion. He was with typical kids who were developing. They found parts of him that they just enjoyed and they just were able to connect with him. And so it's when those kids become adults, I'm hopeful that we're going to see some changes and some aloha, because it's all about, you know, I want people to see the aloha in my kid because it doesn't look like everybody else's, you know. And so I think it's those kinds of opportunities that we need to see some of that changes. It's really hard to get, you know, changing adults. That's why we focus so much on training young and up and coming professionals, you know. So I'm hoping it's going to take a generation, because the more they're out there, you know, from my peers, you know, whether they're seeing it through the media and they're experiencing watching a situation on TV or a movie, they'll ask questions. Is that like your house? Does your son respond that way? I think that's there. But, you know, it's just some of the other structural things, you know, we really got to work on.
Tonight we're talking about autism on Town Square, and we want to hear from you, too. Are you having difficulty getting services for your child? Do you find everyone else not necessarily accepting your child? Listening to some of the stories of how children have or haven't been so well accepted, what's your story? We want to hear from you. 941-3689 if you're on Oahu, or 877-941-3689. When we have talked about this through the years, the idea that, you know, it's so hard to get the right thing for my kid. First, because you got to figure out what the right thing is. That's a big hurdle. And then once you may know what that right thing is, try to figure out whether or not you can actually get that need met in Hawaii, or whether you have to go someplace else, or whether it's a matter of a doctor who sort of parachutes in, like I think what Dr. Green does. John Green comes here from Oregon, and others who do similar things, and then off they go. You're shaking your head at me, Jeff. What's up?
It's really hard to access the right kind of service for your kid because autism spectrum is such a wide spectrum. Kids have a variety of different issues and needs. And the most common thing that I see is families who are getting the educational piece from the school, but the kid's not getting any social skills, is totally isolated and doesn't have any interpersonal abilities that will enable them to have gainful employment once they age out of the system. And so they're like coming to different practitioners. But how many psychologists and therapists are there that work with the autism spectrum? I think it's a handful in Hawaii. So it's really not that many providers and not that much access to the kinds of services. And, for example, one of the cool innovations that involves like immersion is peer-based training. So peers do a lot of the pivotal response training and different kinds of services with kids, which is a positive in a number of ways. It helps expose the general population, so to speak, or they call them neurotypical individuals, mm-hmm. to kids on the autism spectrum, and also allows them to be part of the solution and help these kids. I don't know anybody who's actually doing it here. So there's pivotal response training. I don't really know anybody who's doing it here. So some of it may be that they are doing it and I don't know about it, which is quite possible. But some of it may be that it's hard to access these really cool innovative treatments that are now found to be empirically, that have empirical support and are working.
Well, I kind of think, or I'd like to think, that as the past president of the APA, that you would know, HPA, sorry, you would know about this if, in fact, it were being done here. That somehow this network, which we think is not that huge in Hawaii, but maybe not. I mean, if there is someone out there who's doing it, give us a call. But chances are, if you haven't heard about it up until this point, it very well may not be done.
Well, I think
here,
we're still at the infancy of treatments. I mean, I don't think we know how to, quote, cure autism, or how to get a severely autistic child to be functioning. And in some cases, that may never be possible. But in terms of treatment, there are some that are determined to work with some kids, but we're really not there.
Yeah, I think that's why I speak to the pockets of excellence. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I can think of two or three people who are doing pivotal response, but different communities.
Okay, well, we want to hear from those pockets of excellence and also some of the bigger pockets where there are a lot of questions and a lot of needs. 941-3689 is our number, 941-3689, 877-941-3689. If you call us from the neighbor islands. Tonight we're talking about autism, and if it's part of your family's life and you've had a good experience in finding what you need for your child or a not-so-good experience, we want to hear from you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Mike, calling us from Pearl City. Aloha, Mike.
Yes, how you doing?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for your patience.
Not a problem. I just wanted to make a couple comments, one regarding the movie theater situation where one of your guests, she was talking about how the people approached her after the movie about her son talking there in the movie and his behavior. And I think she misquoted or she made a mistake in her description when she said that two adults came over. For those people to act like that to you because your child's in the movie, those people are not adults.
Okay, and they were,
well, you take your point.
And they were childless adults.
Grown, but they are definitely far from adults.
Thank you.
Myself, I am parent of an autistic child. And I take her to the movies. Luckily, she's very well behaved in the movies. But my son, who is not, on the other hand, he's a little wild, you know, child in the movie theaters. And I just want to go on a little tangent here. Comedian Louis C.K., he said something great regarding the faces people make when the child acts up in public. Parents, when they see that child acting up in public, they have a completely different response. They say, what did that child do to that poor woman to make her explode like that? Or what did that child, you know, they set the parent off. When a parent yells at a child, some people say, oh, that's a terrible parent. Or, you know, even when you just admonish a child in public, people be like, oh, what is wrong with that parent? Us parents, we know, you know, oh, man, that child must have really upset the parent. And I'm not saying, you know, that autistic children should be admonished or anything, but with anyone, everyone learns differently. Everyone, they have their own ways of learning things and behavior. And I think we need to address that when it comes to autism as well. Myself, I'm not autistic in any form or way that I know of. I've never been diagnosed with anything. And I mean, I went to school. I got good grades. You know, I physically and mentally, I seem to be normal. But I was a lot worse behaved than my daughter was at that age. A lot worse. But I just wanted to get that out there, you know, that...
All right, Mike, thanks so much for a slice of reality.
Per se.
Yeah, well, I mean, slices of reality and ones that we can all relate to if we're parents of kids. I mean, quite right that any kid sometimes has a meltdown, and we look at the parents in a certain way, or we look at the kid in a certain way, and... Maybe it's a good thing that we don't look differently, perhaps, at a kid and think this kid is autistic or is this kid autistic. We just look at the kid as a kid. But still, it goes back to the point of how free a lot of people feel to pass judgment without a whole lot of knowledge about anything, just based on what they think should be happening. And those shoulds aren't really based in reality either, Jeff.
Yeah, there's a lot of armchair psychologists out there.
Yeah.
Well, and it sort of, you know, goes beyond just being armchair psychology and kind of really drifts over into the obnoxious when you have people coming up and saying things like they did to Leland and her son. We want to hear more stories about your experiences in Hawaii with trying to find the right services for your child, trying to find just what it is that's going on with your kid if your child has been diagnosed as autistic. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Have you had to go off to the mainland? Have you had to look elsewhere to be able to get what your child needs? And has the DOE here been terribly helpful for you? Good stories, not so good stories. We want to hear them all tonight on Town Square. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Jeff and both Maria and Leo jump in on this one, too. For parents dealing with the DOE, we hear so many stories about how difficult it is for them to get services for their kid. If they have whatever special needs they might have, it's so difficult for this in the wake of Felix that things have just devolved. It's a misery for a lot of parents. What about for kids specifically who have autism?
Well, you know, I want to share there's things happening across the state and in different communities. The state was a recipient of some funds to specifically looking at autism. And so each community is handling it very differently. So one advice to families is to ask questions, find out what's happening in your district. So, for example, one of the programs I'm a little familiar with, what's happening in Honolulu District, they've created a special school, and it's like a one-year program by these youngsters are being brought in. You know, they're applying the best practices. They're also bringing in their potentially their teacher at the school that they will be going to later to kind of train in to understand to make sure that they're skilled in the different methodologies. But they also have a parent training component, which I've not seen in any other programs, where once a month the families are coming in and they're actually getting training. And then there's follow up with a home visit just to make sure the families, you know, they can actually are demonstrating the techniques in their home. And that's, you know, that's a great approach. But, you know, it's a project they're just starting. I think the school's been up for about a year now. And it's almost like a school within a school.
Is the school specifically for kids with autism?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, wow.
There are several of these beachheads happening. There's
that's fantastic.
A program by a psychologist where they brought in families, well, parents, parents of autistic children once a week to do a workshop for an hour or 2 hours with the parents on coping and stress having a child who has autism spectrum disorder.
Because my heart just goes out to the parents. I was just reading in a book called Far From the Tree, a whole section on autism and the agony of the parents. You know, just the daily stress and agony of having, these are kids who are severely, severely autistic, and some of them, you know, have to be placed outside the home because of their behavior. But I just, you know, it's hard enough being a parent in any way, shape, or form, much less when you go through that. So to have that kind of support is just
it's beachheads. And the thing that I think is distracting to people is the fact that the services are there, but they're just beginning, and there's such a need. We haven't even talked about the level of comorbidity, which means that a lot of these children have other conditions like depression or anxiety. Uh-huh. Or OCD kinds of things going on while they have autism spectrum disorder. And the Department of Education's model is an educational model, not a clinical model. So the DOE isn't there to try to treat those conditions. They're there to help the child learn. And so who's there to provide the additional supports to address depression or anxiety and social isolation? I noticed Dr. Bowman in his workshop a couple weeks ago said what we now know is that these kids actually may really want relationships, but they're self-isolative, perhaps because they've had so many experiences of failure that they have given up trying to interact with other people. And rather than just say, well, the kid's socially self-isolative, let's just kind of give them social skills training and force them in, there needs to be a lot of specialized programming and experts coming in to design those programs. And, you know, we're just starting.
Is it fair to expect that that's going to come through the school system, or that should be part of the school system? I mean, where does the school leave off and all the rest of what a child needs for his or her own development, particularly if it's an autistic child, pick up?
You've just asked the $64,000 question. That line is blurry. We don't know. Sometimes we say, well, according to the contents and performance standards in Hawaii, we should be addressing career and life skills,
but
which should include things like that.
How can a kid, you know, pass those cognitive tests if they have severe autism, if they cannot speak, if they have schizophrenia? I mean, if they're being bullied and they don't go to school, if they're so depressed or suicidal, I mean, it's like you can't just say, I'm gonna focus on test scores without, you know, considering
who's being tested
with the child. Yeah. And if they're even able to be there. And I think with autism, it falls through the cracks because partly it's a developmental disorder and partly it's a mental health disorder. And then so who's going to take responsibility? Either or both systems.
So how do you assess one or both of those systems now when you look at them?
Well, with the DOE, if there's a severe mental health disorder, then that child is to be seen and treated by the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Division of the Department of Health. So it's supposed to, the child's treatment is supposed to move to a different department if it's severe. That's what's supposed to happen.
And in practice?
Does it always happen? Probably not. I mean, there's a disconnect sometimes, quite a bit, in terms of getting the kids the services they need. And in terms of autism, you guys probably know better than I do when the services, when the needs are so great. What do the schools do about them?
Right. So, you know, so I think, you know, there's been an increased number of children who are receiving services through the Developmental Disabilities Division, mm-hmm. and specifically their Medicaid waiver to provide in-home supports and community access and community living. And I think 5 years ago, there were not as many children. And so I think it's that burgeoning. You know, we're starting to see new providers surface, providing different kinds of services, more community inclusion. So I think for our higher-end kiddos, I think we're seeing, you know, the application of services, but the ones that, you know, just aren't so high-end needs, they're maybe academically performing well, but, you know, they just couldn't talk to, you
Again,
know.
It's complicated. One of the things that I see a lot is people criticizing the Department of Education for being interventive rather than preventive. They wait until the child starts to fall apart, and then they'll put the services in place, rather than recognizing that if we put the services in place in the beginning and keep them and sustain them, even when the child is improved, we can avoid slippage or, you know, regression when there's a significant change in the child's life. For autism spectrum, it can be as simple as a new skills trainer. Or a new teacher.
Puberty.
Or, you know, developmental factor, an environmental thing can trigger. Maybe a sibling goes off to college. All those things can suddenly increase the symptoms, and you might see a regression. And then it takes, you know, sometimes days to weeks to reinitiate services. The DOE then has to do another evaluation, perhaps, and there's a 60-day timeline, and we get into all those bureaucratic challenges.
Well, backpedaling is always more time-consuming and often more costly, which goes back to your initial argument about why aren't we being more preventative in our approach?
I think they're starting to change. I think the Department of Education is making some real strides in that area. The example that Leo gave is one. And I think that there's a recognition that parents are also becoming more savvy and mm-hmm. more advocacy oriented. So they're kind of saying, you know, if my child regresses because you've taken the service away, you're not really, you know, safeguarding my child. And if something happens, it's going to be on you.
Well, let's test that a little bit. Are you a savvy parent if you have an autistic child? Have you, unfortunately, had to just do a lot of it yourself by the seat of your pants because you are your child's best advocate? What have you learned that you'd like to pass on? We want to hear from you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you call us from the Neighbor Islands, or if you're listening to the live stream, that's the number to call. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Bill calling from Kaimuki. Aloha, Bill.
Aloha, and it's Phil. Thank you.
Oh, I'm very sorry.
Not a big deal. I wanted to, first of all, I appreciate this conversation. Thank you very much. I wanted to share a couple of experiences that I have had working with children with these kinds of disabilities. And one of them is I spent a time working at McKinley High School in a classroom with an absolutely brilliant teacher. And a classroom full of children with an entire spectrum of disabilities, including those of autism. And my friends used to ask me, how can I work with these kids? And my answer is, and still is because while they have these disabilities, the one thing that I know for sure is that their spirit is whole. And what I did is I did everything I could to respond to the spirit of these children.
And what do you do when you work with these children? Are you a special ed teacher?
No, at the time I was a skills trainer.
And what skills specifically were you working on with these children?
Well, there were all kinds of skills. We had to work on math skills. We had to work on social skills. It was very one-on-one intensive.
And how many children?
Hygiene skills.
How many children were in your class?
Oh, in her class there were, I'm thinking like 15.
And you were responsible for working with all of them?
Oh, no, no.
Okay,
no.
All right.
I was responsible for working with one or
okay.
two of them.
All right.
And you were
and
able
I,
to...
And I spoke, and I was able to communicate with them just because I'm very conscious of the spirit of people. And
well, those children certainly were very...
I wanted to share that with you.
Well, thank you so much for calling about that. It's a good thought to remember about probably most people. Thanks, Phil, and we've got your name right now. Thanks very much for the call.
All right. Mahalo. Aloha.
Aloha. 941-3689 is our number, 877-941-3689. If you have a child on the autism spectrum, autism disorder spectrum, we want to hear from you and hear really what you think the state of autism is in Hawaii. What are your best successes, and what are sometimes the most difficult things you have to go through in trying to get the right services for your kid, even figuring out what those right services are? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going now to Linda calling us from Palolo. Aloha, Linda.
Aloha. I just wanted to say a couple of kind words in Leolinda's
Thank you,
direction.
Linda.
The reason I called was that I think some of the people who make the most profound impact on the systems are people who tend not to be very self-congratulatory, and they quietly but relentlessly chip away at these issues in great earnestness, despite the fact that institutions may not be as responsive as we'd like. And so I just wanted to say that I think we rely on institutions a lot, and we tie their ability to respond to these issues to budget and other economic factors, but some of the most profoundly beneficial work comes from families working together at the community level, and communities do that more successfully and come together to move the system toward more progressive practices when they have the support and they're assisted in learning how to organize and to help support systems change. So Leolin is not the sort of person who's going to be boastful about all the heavy lifting she's done over the years, but her commitment and many like her have been relentless in trying to make the system better, trying to build bridges between the institutions and the communities and the families. And then I
got to tell you, she's sort of shaking her head and turning a bit pink at the moment. And I know, though, she appreciates your kind words. But as you look out generally over Hawaii, And what we know about autism right now and how we are able to help families right now, where do you put us on your own spectrum of how well we're doing?
Well, I guess the fair thing to say would be that I think there's institutional inertia. The Department of Education, Department of Health are huge agencies, and there are many people that work within them with earnest intent to make the system better. But during times of economic downturn or, you know, budget stresses, these are the kinds of things that tend to get less attention than perhaps other issues. So I don't think that it is getting the attention it deserves. I think that the problems of providing the appropriate services to families with children who are dealing with autism is still a little behind where it should be. Maybe a lot behind where it should be. And I think it's an institutional inertia issue. And I think one of the things that will change that is effective organizing of families at the community level.
Which sort of brings us to a point about networking. And I think you said it beautifully. Linda, thanks so much for the call. But I want to talk to those of you around the table about a couple of things before we have to say goodbye. And that is how families are networking with each other now to be able to create those communities within communities and not waiting for it to be top down with something with the DOE or the Department of Health or, you know, what the ledge says about autism or cutting monies, any of that. But really that truly ground up movement. And also how you view what's happened at the state legislature, and especially as we're kind of even looking forward into 2014 and the coming session.
Yeah, I think that parent networking is key. That parent-to-parent support is a number one, because that's where you're going to learn about how to wash your kid's hair when your child is sensory aversive. You know, that's where you're going to learn the tricks of the trade. That's where you're going to get the support. That's who's going to support you when you have that incident like we had at the movies. Another parent will understand where that comes from. So it's critical. I think technology has made it so much easier for us to stay in touch.
More assistive technology?
Oh, yeah. We know of virtual family support groups. You know, so you don't even have to leave your house to be able to access a family. You know, texting. We're seeing
FaceTime is good too.
FaceTime, Skype. Exactly. So I think, you know, where we are technology wise has just really enhanced that network and access to information, and it's just so critical. And you know, fostering the ability for families to get together and to communicate, you know, is critical. So we're seeing that. We're seeing more and more. There are more family support groups that are available. One of the support organizations actually has what they're calling, I think they're like coffee talks, where they're creating little community groups of people to come together just to chit-chat about their families. Maui has a very strong family group that gets together monthly at McDonald's and just to, you know, thematically talk about things.
So where are some of you guys? It's awfully quiet out there. And we know that this is a touchy issue and it's tough and maybe you deal with it all day and don't necessarily want to talk about it. But you know, Leo, you make the point that we've got a good opportunity to be able to share that good information. And right now you've got the radio on which you can do it. 941-3689. We want to hear from you if your family is a family dealing with autism and how well you're doing that. Is something could possibly help another family. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Maria.
I just wanted to add two things. I totally, of course, agree with Leah Linda, and as a person who's struggled myself, the importance of having peer support, somebody who knows what you're going through. There's nothing that can replace that. In terms of money, I just wanted to mention the Autism Foundation, which their mission is to raise money for autism research, and that's a local group in Hawaii that I think is a little new to the scene and is doing some really wonderful things. And then you mentioned the legislature, and Leo and Jeff, I think you can talk about this, but we had another defeat at the legislature this year for, what, the 7th time or the 11th time or... whatever.
But much too long, long time.
And didn't this one, we thought we got it?
Well, yeah. It was looking good there, what, in about April, and then sort of tanked.
It was looking good all the way through.
Let's tell
I mean,
them what
there
it
wasn't
is.
A single, I don't think there was anybody who was openly opposed.
Tell them what it is.
The autism, there's an autism services bill which provides for insurance companies to reimburse providers who are providing services to children on the spectrum. Mental health services. It's kind of ties in with mental health parity and the requirement that insurance companies have to address mental health concerns to the same degree that they address medical concerns. I mean, if an individual has diabetes and has to come in for regular checkups, why would you not also provide the same service to someone who is on the spectrum? So the issue, though, is that that could be a significant expense because the services for autism spectrum youth are very expensive and time-consuming. These kids need daily intensive therapy, and a lot of parents out of pocket are forking over $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year. So the bill was designed to provide for insurance companies to meet a $50,000 a year cap and a $300,000 a year lifetime cap to provide mental health services to children on the spectrum. And all the community groups and families came out in favor of this bill. And we don't know what happened, but somehow or other, in the back room, on the 23rd hour, the bill was killed. I have my suspicions, but I don't know if it's the appropriate venue for airing them.
Yeah, families go bankrupt.
Up to you. You can say what you like. And not have to feel that any holds are barred here. But the point being that it was looking so good all the way through April, and then suddenly we came to almost the end of the session. It seemed like everything just fell right through the floor.
As far as I knew, it was going through. And everybody was talking about it being a win. So to this day, I'm still scratching my head. I remember
not counting chickens before they hatch.
Asking my colleagues here at the table what happened. And they shook their heads and shrugged their shoulders. We don't know.
All right. But what we do know right now is we have several callers on the line. And if you want to get in on this discussion, do it now, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Mike from Mililani. Aloha. Welcome
to Town Square. Yes, how are you doing
today? Hi there.
It's me again. Yeah, I called earlier about the theaters. But anyway, I just wanted to talk about the stigma that does come with people seeking help for children who are autistic, because for parents and stuff. When my child was first born, and maybe about 2 years old, some people around us said that they thought maybe something might be wrong, you know, that she might be suffering from some type of mental illness or, you know, maybe even autistic. And at first, I refused to believe it. I denied it. No, there's nothing wrong with my child. She's perfect, I said. There's nothing wrong with her. She doesn't have that. She's perfect. My wife, fortunately, is much smarter than I am, and did seek avenues to find out and get her diagnosed, and we found out that she did have mild autism, and we were able to get her into a program to help her along, and she's doing really good now. And I finally realized that my way of thinking was wrong, and my child has autism, but she is perfect. And I think other parents need to realize that just because your child might suffer from something does not make them any less. They are still your child, and you should love them and realize that, like I said, my daughter, she has autism.
Yeah, right, but the point, Mike, is that you look at your child as your child and not somebody else's ideal or their idea of perfection. Thanks very much for calling.
It's kind of like what Phil was talking about being able to connect with a child's spirit.
It's a good thing for the rest of us to remember, too, not just if you happen to have a kid who has autism, but how we regard this idea of being perfect and what this perfect behavior is and what the perfect child
no
is.
No such
perfect.
Thing.
There is no such thing. We tell each other that kind of, you know, logically, and yet if there's something wrong, or as we talked about earlier, that once upon a time you'd hear a diagnosis of autism, and it was almost akin to a death sentence. That, you know, putting this child away and putting this child away from your mind and your heart, and not trying to bring any more hurt into your life because all of a sudden you find out that your child has autism. It took us a long time to get through that and just realize it's something else, but you can deal with it.
And in those times, you were blamed for it. As a parent, it was your fault. That's what the attitude was. So not only did you have this death sentence for your child, but it was almost a death sentence for you because you had caused it.
Thank you, Sigmund Freud.
Mm-hmm. And Bruno Bettelheim.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of makes you want to say, you know, what is it that we're really learning? And how are we learning about it now in such a way that we don't perpetuate those kinds of, you know, horrible stigmas to parents who have no real control over this? I mean, no parent says, gee, I think I'll have a kid with XYZ, fill in the blank. Everybody wants to have a quote-unquote healthy, good, loving child and all the things that we hope for as parents when we're waiting to have children. But that goes kind of back to you doctor folks and how you deal with the rest of us.
Well, there's I think a lot of people who provide services to children and individuals on the spectrum, it's sometimes a lot more work than you get paid for. And we all have to kind of make a living and survive. And a lot of the work that we do is just for families with the children on the autism spectrum, often there's a disproportionate amount of need. So that, I mean, their child needs a lot. They need a lot of support services. There may be additional complicating factors. The marital stress rate is higher in this population. So it's almost like you can keep on giving and giving as a provider and still not meet the need of the families. And so at times it can be a real burnout module. So as providers, I think it's important to make sure you address that and take care of yourselves and have maybe some variety and what you do, and also for hopefully a lot of parents and people out there to thank their providers for doing what they do and helping them out, so that the provider doesn't think it's just I get paid and I do my job.
Because you're a person too, and you'd like to feel that you're making a difference. Same thing is true when you talk about taking care of yourself if you're a doctor dealing with patients who have autistic kids or just have high needs in general, how much that takes out of you energy-wise. But if you are someone who's on the line 24/7 like the parents are, I would think that same idea would apply, that you need to get some respite and you need to get some time for yourself or you really will lose it, and then consequently so will your child.
You know, I think that's such a valuable lesson, but it's such a hard concept. You know, I think, you know, culturally, you know, you're supposed to be taking care of everybody else. You know, you're the parent, you're supposed to be taking care of everybody else. The fact that sometimes you've got to put yourself first, put the oxygen mask on before you can put somebody else's oxygen. I mean, they tell us that on the airplanes, but somehow we haven't internalized that that's what we have to do with our families. That as parents and caregivers, we've got to take care of us first before we can take care of everyone around us. And that's not something that's necessarily reinforced a lot, you know, in society, because, you know, we tend to think, oh, well, you know, it's you're being selfish, you're putting yourself first. But, you know, in actuality, you know, when push comes to shove, we've got to be able to respond.
And mothers are usually last on the list anyway. Yeah. No offense to fathers, but, yeah. You know, mothers tend to feel like, you know, gee, if I walk out of the house and I'm clean, it's a good day.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
Then there's also that stigma of getting help once again. You know, the parent, you know, there's a lot of shame in that for
what's wrong with you. You can't do it
to
yourself.
Admit that they need help.
There's more than that. Once they are perhaps getting help, the help is hard. The work that we're asking them to do, to be aware of the triggers of their child, to be aware of their own behaviors and how their behavior triggers certain responses in their child that may be under their stimulus control, is really a challenge for a lot of parents. And they may falter and their child may have a meltdown and then they feel bad about it, that they're not worthy of providing the services, and that the doctors, like myself, make it sound so easy. You know, we write it all down on a nice tablet for them and show them how to do it, and we practice. And it's a very stressful thing, I think, for parents.
As we're coming to the last part of the show, I want to just go around the table and take a look forward. We've got a coming session where no doubt some of the same legislation will show up again. I mean, one of these years, you're going to be in the position that many other organizations have been, where finally the wall gets knocked down. It's just how many years until you come to that point. So what's the plan for this next year? Is there a plan for this next year? As you talk to families, Leo, and you talk to other docs and people who are on the front lines too, how do you get our folks who will be down there at the state capitol to understand it more than they did last year, or at least be willing to act on it?
Well, I think, you know, I think we have a lot of supporters this year in the legislature themselves that thought that it was going to go through, and they're not. And so I think they're calling for questions, you know, to kind of get some more accountability. I think the advocacy is going to be that much more stronger because we were so close. I think this year has brought strengthen the alliance between the organizations, you know, to try to move the discussion forward. I think one of the barriers is, you know, what's the impact of the Affordable Care Act, especially in Hawaii, because it's so easy to take the wait and see what happens with the ACA before we do something. But I think it's just going to be, you know, strategic wise, is hit them hard, hit them fast, and hit them early.
Jeff?
I agree with everything Leo said. And I would add that I think one of the big barriers is money, that the insurance companies and folks who are the holders of the money are thinking this is going to be very expensive. And despite actuarial studies that were done and indications that the increase would not be significant, I think that they don't believe those numbers, that people want to believe what they want to believe, and they also are fearful. And so there's a wait and see rather than a willingness to take a chance.
Yeah,
even though it'll probably be far less costly if they do take a chance. And Maria?
Well, just that if we're talking about cost, you know, you're going to really save cost in the long run if you get treatment, if you get kids treatment. In the long run, it's much less costly to society. So
that's the oldest story I know.
Yeah. And that's the thing, that's the refrain we hear for so much of what we talk about when it comes to mental health.
Yeah, yeah.
The question is, one day, will they actually believe it?
Right.
Enough to act on it. Well, we've got a little ways to go until we hit January and the next session, which means you've got to start
getting busy right now.
Right now to get going and move forward. We'll check in with you as we go, as we did last year, to see what's happening, and hopefully we won't get all the way down to the end of the session to find that it goes through the floor again. Thanks, all of you, for being
thank
here.
You.
Maria Grams, Jeff Stern,
thank you,
and
Leo
and the Parlin for joining us to give us an insight from your perspectives on what's happening in the world of autism in Hawaii. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. I'm going to see you tomorrow morning for The Conversation, and then back here again next week for The Town Square right about this time. And in the meantime, have yourselves a good evening. Aloha.